Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.
Okay, so let's pick up with the Ramban. So we're working through this end of the story, the part in which Yaakov and Esav now actually meet, in which Yaakov implores Esav to accept all the gifts. They embrace, they hug. Yaakov begs him to take the gifts, which he does. Esav asks, let's travel together. Yaakov rejects it. Esav says, I'll send some men with you. Yaakov rejects it. He says, I'll meet you up in Har Seir. We'll meet up at a later date. And then he finds himself in the city of Shechem, and he builds huts for himself and for his cattle, which we'll see the different languages, houses and Sukkot. And that's the basic rundown. That's where we are up to right now. Okay, let's do the Ramban's commentary to all of what's taking place. I remind you, as we're going to see, I believe we'll get to it today, but if not, I'll mention it already now. The Ramban has told us many times that this episode of Yaakov and Esav meeting together, there are three episodes really, are the story of the Jewish people in exile. And that the sages see within the story the way that Yaakov interacts with Esav and the way that the story unfolds, lessons for us. And we've seen a number of comments the Ramban has already made as far as what we learned from the story. And again, I'm just putting that as a foreshadowing as to, as he's going to comment on the story, that's the backdrop of what he has already told us. Okay, picking up the first comment of the Ramban is actually on Pasuk Hey, the fifth verse, but we'll just start from, I'm on page 200 and 201, just in case you weren't sure which side was the first side of your blue sheets in front of you. 200 and 201 is where we're starting, chapter 33, which begins right in the middle of the page, verse 1. Yaakov raised his eyes and saw, behold, Esav was coming in with him with a 400 men. I'm just going to read it in English to get to the verse that we need. So he divided the children among Leah, Rachel, and the two maidservants, and he put the maidservants and their children first, Leah and her children next, and Rachel and Joseph last. Then he himself went on ahead of them and bowed earthward seven times until he reached his brother. Esav ran toward him, embraced him, fell upon his neck, and kissed him. Then they wept. He raised his eyes and saw the women and children, and he asked, who are these people of yours? And Yaakov answered, the children whom God has graciously given your servant. So this is the first place where Ramban makes his comment. Esav saw both the women and the children. And when he asked, says the Ramban, I'm on the bottom of the left-hand side of the page. Got a little bit cut off, I apologize about that. Why does Esav ask about women and children? And what does Yaakov answer? Just read. He only answers about the children. He doesn't talk about the women. Esav very clearly asks about both. Verse 5, he raised his eyes and saw the women and children, and he asked, who are these people of yours? The Torah is making it very clear that he saw both the women and the children when he asked, who are these people of yours? And Yaakov responds, the children whom God has graciously given me, says the Ramban. Esav was asking, five lines from the bottom on the left-hand side of the page again, Esav was asking about both the women and the children, but Yaakov only answered about the children whom God has graciously given your servants. Says the Ramban, Derech Musar, it was out of propriety, for he did not want to say explicitly that they were his wives. But Esav understood that they were the mothers of his children. The Ramban makes a very simple and interesting comment here, that within these little dialogues that the Torah tells us, in which Esav says, hey, who are these women and children? Who are these people to you? And Yaakov says, the children have been graciously bestowed upon me by God. There's an element of musar, an element of propriety, which is interesting to see how different it is in the world that we live in which Yaakov felt would be inappropriate to introduce his wives head on, openly, and saying, these are my wives. And that it would be more appropriate in the sense of modesty to say, these are the children that Hashem has blessed me with. And it would be understood that the women standing behind them were his wives. And that would be a more appropriate modicum of propriety, of tznius, of modesty, than saying it directly. I share that with you, A, because the Ramban says it, so I share it. And B, it's always interesting, again, the world we live in is so different in some ways that you feel like, wow. That was the way that they treated themselves, the way that he responded to his wives, that it would be inappropriate for me to overtly say, this is my wife Sarah, and my wife Rachel, my wife Leah, whoever may be in the case here. So he just says, these are the children, and the women standing behind would be assumed to have been the mothers. Yeah?
When they said that, who are these people of yours? Isn't the answer contained in the question? They're his people.
Well, are they servants? Are they wives? Are they children? Are they who are they? I mean, they were clearly in his camp, but he wants to know what's the relationship here. So he says, these are the children I've been blessed with, and it's understood that these are my wives. Okay, let's move on. I just thought we would start with that, since that's what the Ram starts with. Okay, moving on. Going just through the psukim. So Yosef and Rachel, the next comment is in verse 8. Verse 7 is, Yosef and Rachel came forward. I skipped the verse, right?
Yeah,
and verse 6, the maidservants came forward. They and their children, they bowed down. Leah, too, came forward with her children, and they bowed down. And then afterwards, Yosef and Rachel came forward, and they bowed down. And then Esav asks the question in verse 8, who is for you the whole camp that I met? It's a very strange question. Like, what is this whole camp that I met? Meaning, referencing all of the gifts that had been sent prior. Remember, it was an enormous amount of flock, cattle, animals that Yaakov had sent. So Esav now meets the family, and he asks, like, what is all of these things that you have sent me? And Yaakov responded, to gain favor in my Lord's eyes. That was Yaakov's response to that question. Says the Ramban, two approaches to understand what the question here was. What did Esav mean when he said, what is all of these? What was all that thing that you sent me? Says the Ramban, beginning of verse 8, on page 202, Yaakov's messengers were instructed to present Yaakov's gifts to Esav and explain its purpose. So why is he asking this question? Meaning, if you go back to the beginning of the first part of the story which we read, when Yaakov sent the gifts, he said to his servants, when you get to Esav, and he asks you, what is this, and to whom is it? You shall say to him, it is a gift from your servant Yaakov, who has sent us to find favor in your eyes. So why is Esav now asking what was the purpose of all of that gift that had already been made clear? Says the Ramban, approach number one, Yaakov's servants surely did as he had instructed them and brought the tribute to Esav. V'lorotzel akabel mehem. However, he did not want to accept it from them, just as he did not want to accept it now. So that the meaning of the question is, like, what is all of this? What's his way of saying, and I don't want them? Almost like a rhetorical, like, why are you sending me these things? I have no interest in them, I have no need for them. And I know what it is. I know that you're the one who sent it. Why are you doing that? I don't want them. And that's the meaning of the question when he says, what is all of this to you? Mm-hmm. Alternatively, the Ramban suggests another thing, which is interesting when we see this, the second pshat. Keep this in mind. Says the Ramban, in his haughtiness, Begaav also, and in his anger at Yaakov, Esav did not speak to the servants at all, and did not ask them, whose are you and where are you going? The question, we don't know what happened when they got there. The Torah tells us that Yaakov says to his servants, when you meet Esav and he asks you, who are you, whose do these belong, and where are you going with them? That was Yaakov projecting what Esav would ask. You should say to them, they're from your servant Yaakov, he's come to find favor in your eyes. Says Ramban, from this question that we see here that Esav asks, we might intuit, not that it's a rhetorical question because he knows, he has no idea. He has no idea what they were for. Why would he not know what they were for?
He
never spoke to them. Why would he not speak to them? That Ramban intuits or interjects, because he's still harboring all of that anger and resentment from what had taken place. Why did Yaakov leave 20 plus years before? Because Esav wanted to kill him. We have had no interaction in between, other than Yaakov sent messengers saying, I'm coming back. And what does Esav do? Comes out to greet him with 400 men, presumably to wage war. Then Yaakov sends the messengers with the gifts. And when Esav shows up, he says, what was all those gifts for? Says Ramban, it is distinctly possible that Esav has no idea, because he would not even accept and welcome those guests, those servants who had come to give the message, out of his anger and hatred for what had taken place, so he really doesn't know. Then again, continuing the Ramban, he never heard from the servants the question, or asked them, whose are you and where are you going? And the servants themselves were too frightened to approach him and volunteer this information. And therefore, he now asks, who is for you this whole camp that I'm at? What is that? Now, if, as Ramban suggested, Esav did not even meet with the bearers of Yaakov's tribute at all, then how did he know they belonged to Yaakov at all? How did he know to say to him, what was that gift? Maybe they came from some other stranger on the road. Says the Ramban, three possible suggestions. Number one, for he assumed they were Yaakov's because of the words of the first messengers. Meaning, if you remember the very beginning of the story, before the gifts were just messengers. Vayishlach Yaakov malachim el Esav achiv leimor. He sent messengers to Esav saying, I'm coming home. Remember, that was before the gifts. So that Esav figured, I just got this message from my brother Yaakov that he's coming home. And then a day later, this massive tribute comes. So he knew, who did it come from? It came from Yaakov, obviously. That's how he knew. Alternatively, the second messengers related this information in Esav's camp. Meaning Esav himself wouldn't accept them, he wouldn't entertain them. But meanwhile, the messengers didn't come home with the flock, right? Yeah, the Torah doesn't say that they returned to Yaakov with the flock, they left them with Esav. Who'd they leave him with? Right? Esav's men. So they said, listen, Esav's not accepting us. So, but we're Yaakov's men, we bought this gift for him, so here, take him. So that's how he knew they came from Yaakov. Or alternatively, there was no other person other than Yaakov on that road who could have had such a large amount of livestock. Says Ramban, Esav just knew, not possible that anybody else would have had such a lot. Remember the size of the gift? Right? Well over 500 animals were sent in pretty quick succession. That's a massive gift. So, and that was just a part of Yaakov's wealth. So says the Ramban, again, he's giving us two basic approaches here. The first thing that Esav says to Yaakov when they meet up is, what was all that? So Rashi's understanding and the Ramban's first understanding was, meaning, I don't want it. He was saying rhetorically, I know what it was. I know it was a gift to find favor in my eyes. I got it. But I'm asking you, what's that about? Why are you doing that? The Ramban gives a second approach. He's asking because he has no idea. Think, what was that? Why does he have no idea? That's an insight into the nature of the relationship. Remember we said, when does Yaakov cry? When they first embrace a few verses earlier. Only after Esav runs forward, falls on his neck, embraces him, gives him a kiss, then Yaakov cries. And we said, why? So we suggest on a very simple level, because he has no idea how Esav is going to greet him. He has no idea. If you take the second approach of the Ramban, we have further proof to that. Because when the messengers came back, according to the second interpretation of the Ramban, when the messengers came back, they left with 500 livestock, they come back empty-handed, and Yaakov says, "Nu, how did it go?" And what do they say? He wouldn't see us. He wouldn't say anything to us. Did you give him the message? We couldn't. We left all the stuff with his servants. Right? Now the Torah says, Yaakov prepared for war, he divided up the camps, he put the women behind the church. All of a sudden, it's a new, with this Ramban, when the Ramban says, if that's the first question that Esav asks, what was that? And that's very likely, he has no idea. Go back over the story. Put yourself back in Yaakov's shoes when he's left alone with the angel, he's crossing over his camp. He's afraid. He divides up the camp. He prepares for war. He's bowing down on the way there. Why is he bad? He's ready because Esav wouldn't even speak to his servants. Esav falls on his neck, cries, hugs him, kisses him. Now Yaakov can cry. And you can imagine what that cry was like. Thinking he's getting ready to fight Esav and his 400 men. No idea what's coming. And then he sees his brother for the first time in 20 plus years, and his brother falls on his neck and doesn't try to harm him, but just with a hug and a kiss, and he lets out a cry. I remind you also, we saw the dots on top of the word, and he cried, and he kissed him. The sages saw two interpretations of that. Remember what the two were? One is that it was a real kiss, as opposed to Esav's normal behavior. And one, that it wasn't a real kiss, and even though it looked like one, because he ran and he hugged and kissed him, but he was still holding something back because he wasn't really sure what was going on. Put that into the two interpretations that the Ramban gives here as to how Esav received the gifts. Did he actually receive them and take them? And now he's just saying, but I don't want them? Or was he still so filled with anger and hatred that he never even took them, and you can put those two possibilities that the sages give us for how he kissed them, would fit right into both of those either, whether or not it was a real kiss or whether or not it was not quite a full kiss. But you have all of this going on as they come to their first meeting. Yeah, so far so good? Okay, top again of 203. The Ramban now explains the meaning of the sentence, "Who is for you this whole camp that I met?" Meaning, according to the second interpretation, the meaning then is, when he says, "Who is this whole camp that I met?" as if to say, who is there for you that you are sending all these things to him? Meaning, that is, who is the one whom you consider so great that you are sending him all of these things? Asa says, so you send these 500 animals, who are you doing that for that you think is so great? Waiting for Yaakov to say exactly as he does. Oh, indeed, that's to you. You are the one who I consider so great that I send all these gifts, and it's to gain favor in my Lord's eyes, for you are the one who is great and is the Lord in my eyes, and I've prepared this tribute for you. So that's all that second interpretation of the Ramban, that Esav, when he asked what was this for, is because he really had no idea. He had never even bothered to accept the gifts in the first place. So far, so good? Esav responds in verse 9, back up top, "I have plenty, my brother, let you have what remains yours." Again, Esav refers to Yaakov as a brother, something Yaakov himself never does. Yaakov never refers to Esav as a brother, but always as my master, my lord. "I have plenty," Esav says, "I don't want your gift." And Yaakov responds, "I beg of you, please, if I have found favor in your eyes, accept my tribute from me. Inasmuch as I have seen your face, which is like seeing the presence of God, and you have received me favorably." Very strange language. We spoke about this in Rashi. Why is he saying that I've seen the presence of God in your face? Rashi pointed us back to the angel, the wrestling match that had happened previously to this. The wrestling match between the angel, which represented the power, so to speak, of Esav. So Yaakov saying, "Wow, I just saw you just a minute ago. I was having a whole wrestling match with a guy, a divine being that was just like you. Please accept my gift. I mean, Rashi understood, and I have found favor in your eyes as a past tense verb, meaning that I have found favor in your eyes over that which I have done to you in the past, over the sins, so to speak, of the past, of the stealing of the blessings, of the selling of the birthright, and you have found favor in my eyes, or you have forgiven me for all of those things." That was how Rashi understood. Ramban says a little differently. Says Ramban, "Inasmuch as I have seen your face," from the context of the verse, these words seem to be expressing a reason why Esav should accept Yaakov's gifts. Well, why is that? Why should I accept your gift just because seeing my face is like seeing the face of an angel? Says Ramban, "Yaakov said to him, in effect, accept this tribute from me, for I have seen your face, which is for me like seeing the presence of God, and receive me favorably through the acceptance of this tribute, just as God receives favorably those who fear him through the acceptance of their tributes and offerings." What's he referencing, like seeing your face of God? What does one do when a Jew humbly appears before Hashem in the Beis HaMikdash in the Holy Temple in Yerushalayim? What does he bring? He brings offerings. He brings offerings of thanks, offerings of gratitude. And Hashem accepts those, so to speak, from those who have come to find favor before him. So Yaakov says, seeing your face is like seeing the face of an angel. I have brought tributes, I have brought gifts in a hope to find favor, win your favor through the acceptance of them. And just like Hashem accepts these tributes, I therefore beg of you to also please accept this tribute and find favor in my eyes. That I should find favor in your eyes, really. Flipping to the top of page 204, Ramban brings verses where you find a similar concept comparable to the verses, and it shall be accepted favorably for him. You see the idea that the accepting of an offering is something of favor. And the last line in that paragraph, all of them are expressing the idea of a fondness and a desire for something. So Yaakov is saying, please, I have this desire, a fondness to be close, to find favor. Please accept these gifts from me. He quotes Rashi with dislike. He does not like Rashi's approach. That Rashi says it means you have become appeased and forgiven me for my misdeed. Means in the past tense, you have been reconciled with me. And he says, I already know, I don't like that. Why would Yaakov bring that up right now? So it's not that Yaakov was saying to Esav, like Rashi understood it, I have in the past found favor in your eyes. You've accepted me favorably. Please accept these gifts. Why would he bring that up? It's that I want you to now be God-like in accepting these gifts. In finding favor, let me find favor in your eyes, just like I would bring a gift if I were to see Hashem, I would come before His presence. I have brought these gifts before you that it should be an appeasement to you. Okay, again, moving forward quickly, verse 11, please accept my blessing, which was brought to you, inasmuch as God has been gracious to me, inasmuch as I have everything, Yishli Koli said, he urged him, and he accepted. The Rambana, just a quick comment here on the bottom of page 205, what was his, what do you mean, accept my blessings? So the Ramban says the blessings is a reference to the tribute, as Rashi said as well. Similarly, we say, make a blessing with me. And when there's one point in here they want to point out to you, people call it the beginning of the line. It's like halfway through in the brackets. People call a tribute that a person sends willingly a blessing because he sends from that bounty which God has blessed him. Like the idea, Hashem, your God has blessed you, so shall you give him. You will give to your servant, it's referring to the servant you send away after he works with you for 6 years, you will send him with, the according to the blessings that Hashem has given you. Hashem gave you blessings, so you then pass that on, so to speak, and send away your servant with his blessings. However, a tribute of a specific amount that they stipulate to give to the king is called a mas, that's a tax. The Rambam has just an interesting comment. When I willingly open up the storehouses of my blessings, and from that give what I desire from my blessings to you, that gift is called a blessing. I've given you my brachas. Accept birchasi, my blessing. Why do we call the tribute that I'm giving you a blessing? Because it's because of the blessings that I have, I then reach into my storehouse of blessings and I give you of them. When you impose upon me, you'll pay a 10% tax or $1,000 a head, whatever it may be, even though I'm also reaching into my storehouse to take from the blessings that God has given me to be able to pay that, that's not called, I'm now giving you a blessing. That's called a tax. That's a fine. That's a required payment. But when I, on my own, reach into my storehouse and pass it on, that's viewed as, that's indeed a blessing that's being given. Okay, now let's get into some lessons for us as we go through the story. Okay, so far, we've been through the story a couple times already, with Rabban's comments now. Yaakov implores Esav to accept his gift, and he's successful. Esav takes it. Esav had said, I have much. Yaakov says, I have everything. Please take it, and he does. Then Esav initiates the next dialogue, and Esav says in verse, is that 15?
12.
No, 12, excuse me, skip the page. Verse 12, he says, travel on and let us go. I will proceed alongside you. Esav says, okay, I now accepted your gift. We've had this wonderful reunion, brotherly love, you, me, together. Lovely. Let's travel together. I'll escort you back home. Esav says, to which Yaakov says in verse 13, you know, my Lord knows that the children are tender, the nursing flocks and cattle are upon me. If they will be driven hard for a single day, then all the flocks will die. You go on up ahead. We commented, as Rabban is now going to speak at length, what were the three things Yaakov mentioned were under his charge? Children, flocks, and cattle. Nursing flocks, I have the cattle. They're young, they're tender. If I push them too hard, what will happen? What will die?
The
flocks will die. Yaakov said, I have three things under my charge. Children, flock, cattle. If I push too hard, the flocks will die. So Rabban picks up on, that's an interesting way to speak. Why did he do that? Why didn't he mention the three things? What's the most important of the three things?
Children.
But he doesn't mention that as a fear of any damage happening. That should have been his primary concern. I can't push him too hard lest something happen to my children. And he said, the fox will die. Says Ramban on top of page 206, Vamesu kol hatzon, all the flock will die. He said these words out of compassion for his children. For he should have said more generally, they all will die, without specifying the flocks. Why does he say the flocks will die? Say, if I push too hard, they'll die. But he did not allow himself to say that in connection with the children. I think we began to mention this last week also. A Jew doesn't speak that way. He doesn't say the words, my children will die if I push too hard. Don't talk that way. If I push too hard, the fox will die. But I don't even want to say anything more than that. He also did not want to say, and they will die, referring only to the cattle and the flocks, but not to his children. create compassion on the children, they should not be included by the implication. I didn't even want to say a general they, even though in my mind I was only thinking about flocks and cattle. I don't want to leave it open. And he did not want to say at length, all the flocks and the cattle will die. It was just, why bother with such a lengthy expression? So the Ramban, this is like learning a piece of the Talmud right here. The Ramban says, Yaakov has to make an argument. His argument is, I got three things under my charge that are too tender to be pushed. My children, which is the most precious to me, I got my flocks and I got my cattle, I can't. And I want to say, and if I push too hard, now what should I say? I don't want to say that my flocks and my children, my cattle will die. I don't want to say that. So why don't you just say a general, they will die? Yeah, but they will die, even if I'm only thinking about the flocks and the cattle, that implies... So say, the flock and the cattle... God, what a wordy, clumsy sentence. I have children and flocks and cattle. If I push too hard, the flocks and the cattle will die. Well, I don't want to know. So just say, I don't have any other options. I don't want to say they. I don't want to say all. I don't want to say flock and cattle. So I say, if I push too hard... the flock will die. That's the easiest way to accomplish that which I want to say. I have a problem here. I can't push too hard. I don't want to even say the words, my children will die. So in doing so, I figured out a way to say what needs to be said without having to address anything more than that. So says the Ramban, that's how you interpret the phrase, the flocks will die. Says the Ramban, I have another interpretation. Alternatively, the explanation of Yaakov's statement is, my Lord knows that the children are tender, the young ones are weary and falter, so that they don't want to go fast enough to keep up with your camp. Meaning, not that they'll die, I'm not afraid of my children dying. The kids won't die by going too fast. What happens if you push kids too much? They whine, that's what happens. they're not going to die. Now Ramban says, no, this whole first interpretation was this whole thing because I don't want to say the words, which means that he was actually afraid and that Esav would have said, oh yeah, you're right. If you push too hard, your kids will die. Right, that's the Ramban's second approach is, no one's afraid that the kids are going to die. Just that he's saying, I can't. We all know that we can push kids faster than what they're ready to go, but the problem is, we suffer the consequences. They're whiny, they're tired, they're kvetchy, it doesn't work. So what the Ramban meant to say was, listen, I just told you my children are tender, they're weird, you know what that means. That means that that's not going to work. And the tzon and the flocks and the cattle are nursing, and if they are driven hard, the flocks, which are small animals, they will indeed die. And he didn't mention the cattle, because the cattle also aren't going to die, they're just going to get harmed or damaged. So that... you looked at a sentence from a different perspective. He says, I have three things under my charge, children, flock, and cattle. If I push too hard, the flocks will die. Why did he say that? Because that's the biggest damaged. In other words, in the first interpretation, why did he say the flocks will die? Because he didn't have any other options. He's really afraid of everything dying. But he didn't want to say it that way. He didn't want to make it wordy. He didn't want to make it clumsy. So he said the flocks will die. Second interpretation, that's really his only concern, the flocks will die. The cattle aren't going to die by being pushed too hard. Children, they're certainly not going to die by being pushed away. They're just going to get whiny and fetchy, and I don't want to do it. Therefore, he's saying, the worst thing that's going to happen is that the fox will actually die. You understand that, Esav. You might say to me, all right, fetchy children, big deal. But I tell you now, I'm going to lose money. My fox are going to die. Oh, so that was the best argument to make to Esav. So either the two interpretations are, he's concerned about all of them, and he's careful in his words. He doesn't want to say my children will die. Or he's hitting Esav in the place that he'll understand the best, which is the worst damage will be the flocks will die. The cattle will be fine, they'll be a little bit damaged. The children will be fine, they'll just be kvetchy. But you understand I can't do this because I don't want kvetchy children, and you understand that my flocks will actually die. Very interesting, just the way that the Ramban sees in a little nuance of all that Yaakov did is he said, look, I got these problems, the flock will die. From that one phrase, yeah, the Ramban picks up the interpretation that the two possibilities, that's what Yaakov meant. Okay, then Yaakov said, verse 14, let my Lord go ahead. This is still Yaakov's sentence. My Lord, let him go ahead of his servant. I will make my way at my slow pace according to the gate of the herd before me and the gate of the children until I come to my Lord at Seir. I'll get there, he says. I'll catch up to you in Seir. Eventually. Now, as we already saw in Rashi, Yaakov had no intention of going. Was he going to Seir? He was going back to his father. His father's house, his father's homeland. Why does he say, I'll see you in Seir? So the Ramban, Rashi, if you remember, quote, well, the Ramban's going to get to this at the very end. Rashi went right away to the sages of the Medrash that said, when Mashiach comes, l'shpot atar Esav, that we're going to judge those on the mountain of Esav, we'll get there. That it was a reference to the Messianic time. Yaakov would say, I'll meet you in Seir. When? Not in my lifetime, not in your lifetime. Our two nations will meet up. The end of days will meet up. That's where Rashi went to. And Ramban is going to start from Pshat. Before we get to that Medrash, before we get to that, what Yaakov really meant was this allusion to Messianic times. Maybe he meant something more understandable right then and there. Says the Ramban, page 207. Did Yaakov really intend to travel to Seir? Was he putting him off? Says the Ramban, a couple interpretations. Number one, Yaakov had a route to return to his homeland through the land of Seir. It was actually indeed possible that he fully intended on doing so. If you look at note 21, as noted, it's a little bit cut off, but it's the first note on the bottom. As noted above, it is the Ramban's opinion, and that of Ibn Ezra, as opposed to Rav Sajigon, that Seir was located between Haran and Eretz Yisrael. That where Yaakov was coming from was the land of Haran, that's where his uncle Laban had lived, where he's going back to Eretz Yisrael. The Ramban understood that Seir was actually in the middle and Yaakov was going to pass by. Doesn't sound that way from Rashi, that Rashi seems like he held like Rav Sajigon, who placed Seir somewhere else, sort of out of the way, and Yaakov really had no intention of going there. But that the Ramban, in his first interpretation, without getting into the Medrash and Kabbalistic Messianic times, Yaakov went, well, yeah, he said, I'll catch up to you. I'll get there. Back up top in the Ramban. And Esav told him, I will proceed alongside you, meaning that Esav would not separate from Yaakov until Yaakov had returned to his father in order to accord Yaakov honor as Yaakov arrived in his own land. And Esav's offer was, I'll take you all the way there. I'll take you beyond the land of Seir, all the way back to our father's home, giving you the appropriate honor. And Yaakov said, nah, I'll go at my own slow pace. You just go back to the seat of your dominion. You go back to your land that you rule, and we'll catch up another time. And if I return to our father by way of that city, then you can show me honor and go with me as he wishes. But that this was not a promise on Yaakov's part that he would go to Esav, for Esav did not require to come to him that he should make such a promise. Meaning to say, in his first interpretation, when Esav said, I'll walk alongside you, what was he suggesting? I'll give you the covet, I'll give you the honor of escorting you back to our father's home. Past my home, as we go on the way. And Yaakov responded, I can't keep up with you. You go on up ahead, you'll settle on at home, I'll catch up in another week or so. When I pass by, if I pass by, and you still want to, you'll come out and greet me. But it wasn't a promise that Yaakov was saying, I will go that route. Esav was saying, I'll offer to escort you. Yaakov says, it's not good for me or my cattle or my kids. But if I happen to pass by your hometown, you're welcome to join me. Yaakov in the end decided to go a different route and not pass by that way. But the Ramban is saying, as far as Pshat goes, he wasn't leading him on and he wasn't being untrue in any way. It was a distinct possibility he might have gone that route. And he said, if I do, you can join me then. But why don't you just go on by ahead? I'll see if I make it there. Which he, of course, in the end, does not. But that he wasn't saying anything untrue. As opposed to Rashi, who sees it as completely untrue. He had no, it was as if he was promising to do something, which is why he brings in the sages and saying, Yaakov meant there'll be a time in the future that I'll get there. Mm-hmm. And the Ramban is saying on a simple pshat level, no, that was the road. And Yaakov said, I'll catch up. If I get there, you can offer me honor there. But Esav never required it, and Yaakov never promised indeed to do it. Then the Ramban quotes from the sages. The sages saw in Yaakov's words further that, flipping on the page, that it was not Yaakov's intention at all to return by way of Seir. So as far as Pshat goes, again, Ramban says, we can learn it into the simple meaning of the text that that's exactly what he intended, and he just never ended up making there. Well, the sages saw that it was never Yaakov's intent to go there. Indeed, it was his intention to stay as far away from Esav as he could by avoiding Seir altogether. However, he extended the intended route for him, and meaning to get out of the way. And this is indeed a Eitzas Chochmah, a wise piece of advice for how to deal with Esav. Again, the Ramban here is alluding to what we've seen many times, that the interactions between Yaakov and Esav are telling us how we should deal with Esav in our interactions. And the sages saw that he never really had any intention, and if you can get him to that place, and then you circumvent that place, that's the way to deal with Esav. And then he brings a third interpretation that says the sages actually have another midrashic interpretation about this, that it was his intention to get there, just not right then. That Yaakov would indeed fulfill his word to go to Seir in the days of the Messiah, as it says, and the saviors who are on Mount Zion will ascend to judge Mount Esav. And this means that the saviors who are in Mount Zion will go up and administer judgment to those who live on Mount Seir, and Mount the judgment, the Har of Esav. So either on the simple level, he actually was going there, he was going to go right past there, and invited him, he says, if you're still there, when I get there, and I get there, you'll join me. He just never made it. Or he never intended it, and he was literally just saying, you go that way, and I'll just do whatever I can to get away from you. Or additionally to that, the sages say, well, he intended, he didn't want to say something that false completely came out of his mouth. He did intend to eventually get there. He's just going to get there on the back of the Messiah. When Mashiach comes, then he'll get there, and he'll meet up with his brother Esav. Okay, moving on. Okay, moving quickly today. Verse 15 on the top of our page. Esav hears that Yaakov does not want him to accompany him, and he's telling him to go on up ahead. And Esav responds and says, fine, I'll go on up ahead, but let me assign to you some of the people who are with me. If I can't travel with you alone, you don't want me directly, and you have good reasons why it's not going to work for us, at least let me send some of my men to accompany you. They'll help you, they'll protect you, there'll be another pair of hands to help with all the flock and the children. And Yaakov responds and says, why, Lama said, why is this? Let me just have favor in my Lord's eyes. I don't want anything other than the favor in your eyes, but I don't want any of your people coming with me, says the Ramban in verse 15. Why is this? Let me just have favor in my Lord's eyes. The Ramban cites Rashi, why is this that you should do me a favor that I don't need? Let me just have favor in your eyes and do not repay me now with any compensation. Remember, if you saw in Rashi, meaning to say, what had just happened in the previous dialogue? Esav had said, I don't want your gift. And what did Yaakov say? No, please, please, please take it. So what would be the appropriate reciprocal action now when Esav says, let me send men with you? And Yaakov says, nah, I don't need it. Esav says, please, you don't want me? Let me send some men. Yaakov should have said, fine, I'll pay back your kindness of accepting my gift, which was to find favor in your eyes. Now I should accept your offer that you should find favor in my eyes. And therefore Yaakov says, please, I beg you, why is this? Let me just find favor in your eyes. Meaning, please don't do this, that which I don't need. Don't ask me to repay you in the same type of kindness that you did now. Please, I beg of you, don't make this be the type of payment that you're asking of me, that I accept your men to go with me. That was Rashi's comment. The Ramban adds, why was Yaakov so keen to reject Esav's offer to assign some men? Ramban says, Yaakov's intention was that he did not desire them or their company at all. And all the more so we can understand why he rejected Esav's offer to escort if it was his intent to travel in a different route and not go to Seir at all, as the sages cited above. And certainly if his intention was to circumvent Seir at all, he didn't want to go past his homeland, so certainly you see why Yaakov doesn't want him there at all. Now the Ramban says that he notes that the sages derive a lesson from Yaakov's conduct here. Yaakov's rejection, utter rejection of walking alongside Esav, teaches us as follows. The sages saw yet another piece of advice in this story. They say in the Midrash, Rabbi Yanai, when he would go up to have dealings with the government, would look at this passage and consequently not take any Romans with him on the journey. Before he would deal with the Roman government, which was a manifestation of Edom, of Esau's descendants, so before he would deal with them, he would study this passage. This was his preparation. How would he prepare for his meeting? He would learn this passage, he would go over how Yaakov understands and interacts with an Esau, and that would be his preparation for their meeting. And then when he would go up to the government, he wouldn't take any Romans with him. They wouldn't accompany him. Why? Because that's what Yaakov did. Yaakov rejected all escorts from Edom, from Esav. One time, the Medrash says, he did not look at the passage and took some Romans with him. They had not yet even arrived at Akko when he sold his coat. Meaning that he had to sell his coat to yield to the companion's extortion. He had to get the extra money. Meaning he didn't even get very far before those who had accompanied him already had extorted him for all of the money that he had. Because they had had a tradition, meaning the sages did, that this is the Parshas Golos, the chapter of exile. I mentioned this in the very beginning when we started learning Ramban, not just today, but in the very beginning, that the Ramban sees all the allusions of this are all to us today to understand how to live through the exile. And it's called, the sages say that explicitly. The sages see that this third episode of Yaakov and Esav, in which Yaakov prepares to meet Esav on his return home, and he sends the messengers, and then he sends the gifts, and then he prepares for war, and then they actually meet, and he begs Esav to take the gifts, and then he rejects all of Esav's efforts to walk with him, is the Parsha of Golos. It's the chapter that tells us how to deal with the exile. Whenever he went to Rome, to the court of the kings of Edom for some communal matter, he would look into this chapter in order to follow the advice of the Chacham Hazakin, the wise elder, meaning Yaakov. For the future generations were to see from him and his behavior and act in a similar manner. If you ever want to know, like, how should we deal with the nations upon it, in whose lands we live, it's buried in this story. The hints of how the Jew behaves in exile is in this story. And therefore he did not accept the company of Romans to escort him to or from Rome. They do not befriend anyone unless it is for their own personal gain. They might be involved, but if they're involved, you can be sure that on some level there's the personal gain for them that they're involved in it. And they disregard a person's ownership of his own property. And they, as the leaders of the government, have the ability to appropriate any of the land for themselves when they deem. So applies to our government today, which many people lose their land because the government wants to build a highway or do whatever. And that's it. What's it called? What's the word for that?
Eminent domain.
Yeah. Right. And the government has the right, even in our free country, wonderful free countries have been such a blessing for us, and you can just take whatever they want. So they did that in times of Rome as well. So the Ramban here points out that this story, again, is that lesson. Now, he's discussing it on the simplest level of literally not being escorted by a Roman on his way into Rome. That when Rabbi Yannai and the sages had business dealings in Rome and they needed to travel, they didn't want to travel with him because they said, no thanks. Many of the commentators see, and there's many other lessons, that not literally being walked alongside by a descendant of Roman, but the idea of let me accompany you, let me walk together, let us be together in this endeavor. Okay, not me, I'll send some men with you. And Yaakov's response is, I beg of you, I implore you, I don't want it. And this literally is, this behavior is at the core of, in the Jewish world today, which is, as always is so many different camps and factions and different ways of dealing with how the Jew should relate to the world around him. This is the approach of what you'll see, we'll use the spectrum of right and left just because it's easy to understand and people have meaning, but the more to the right you go, whether it be to the world of the Hasidim, to the Haredim, in the Yeshiva, or whatever it may be, is much more of that insular, I don't want anything to do with Esav and his men. I don't want to be surrounded by them, I don't want to be escorted by them, I don't want not him, not his men. You go on and do your thing, just leave me alone to do mine. And that's been an approach in the exile for thousands of years at this point, that says the Jew just doesn't want anything to do with his non-Jewish neighbors. Right. Please, I beg you, leave me alone. And for much of our European history, again, within our European history, and anyone learning our Jewish great history courses, there are times of very great blessings and wonderful relationships with the non-Jews. It happened in Spain, it happened in Poland, it began in Germany that way, and the Jews were very much affiliated and integrated into society. But there always is an element that learns from this and says, just nothing, total insular. I don't want to be impacted, I don't want to be affected, I don't want to be influenced. I just want my own little thing, you go on up ahead. Versus the many other camps that have existed and continue to exist, that even in the exile, that the meaning of Yaakov rejecting Esav is, okay, maybe certain values which we don't want, but it doesn't mean that you have to literally circle your wagon and literally say, don't walk with me, don't go near me, I don't want anything, I live my own little ghetto, self-imposed, and that's how I want to live. But it's clearly rooted in here, on whatever level, that idea of Yaakov's utter rejection of Esav's call to walk together. Esav's call, all right, at least let me send some men with you. Yaakov is clear, nada, nothing, I don't want it, you go on up ahead, I'll catch up later. let me raise my children, let me deal with my flock and my cattle on my own pace, at my own time. I do things differently than you. And so you go on up ahead, and I will deal with mine, and we'll meet up sometime later. Okay, I think I've mentioned before in the past, I'll just repeat it now after what I just said, that there are many commentators also who see in our benevolent exile of the Western world of America post-Enlightenment, which really began back in the 1700s, Enlightenment and the Reform Movement, the exile, the stage of exile that we're in is this stage of Esau's brotherly love exile, of the ghetto walls being broken down during the period of the Enlightenment, culminating with the total assimilation of the melting pot of America, in which anything goes and everyone's a part, and we welcome you, walk alongside us, together, hand in hand, and the damage that that's done to the Jewish people is just immeasurable. The numbers, the millions and millions of Jews that have been lost from Judaism because of that approach, Esav has certainly done a job walking alongside the Jewish people, and that's the response that you get from those who say, absolutely not, nothing, I don't want anything from the culture, I don't want anything of the values. You have to remain circle defensive, circle of wagons, and leave it totally isolated and insular from that. Okay, let us move forward. So Yaakov succeeds. Esav in verse 16 returns on his way. He starts back that day on his way towards Seir. And Yaakov journeyed to Sukkot. And he built himself a house. And for his livestock he made shelters, he made sukkahs. And he therefore called the name of the place Sukkot. Says Ramban in verse 17, Yaakov was clearly not planning on settling here permanently. Why then did he build a house for himself and shelters for his livestock rather than renting living quarters for himself and livestock? We know he's moving on back to his homeland, so why did he do all this? Says Ramban, it is possible that the place where Yaakov found himself was a place where there was no city, and therefore he found it necessary to build himself a house and shelters for his animals. That's number one. Alternatively, he built himself a house means that he built himself a large house with a fortified tower which would be protected from Esav should Esav attack. Now that's a very interesting comment that Ramban makes, because that means that at the end of the day, when Yaakov rejects Esav's plea to walk with him or to send his men, Yaakov never rested easy. He never felt that there was a reconciliation and that he's done, he's covered, he doesn't have to worry about anything. Even after they parted ways, and this again, as the Ramban alludes to, is the approach of the Jewish people in exile, it's never a sense of, I'm safe from Esav. We exchanged gifts, I gave him my gift, he offered the man, I said no thank you, we parted ways, everything was good. What's the first thing that Yaakov does? Builds himself a fortress to protect himself. Because he's never really sure that Esav is indeed not going to attack. And again, lesson for history, the Jewish people always sort of need to be prepared to defend themselves from an attack from Esav. Even when it seems that everything was reconciled, it seems that everything was good, Esav goes on his way, Yaakov goes on his way, says in Ramban, the first thing that Yaakov does is he protects himself, which is a fascinating insight that even after the reconciliation, what he's doing is he's building fences. He's building protections for himself and for his livestock. Let us leave off here. We'll pick up with this next little paragraph, the final paragraph, as we got to until the end of the chapter. We'll pick up with Ramban, and we should be able to finish that pretty easily next week, and then we'll go straight to Rav Hirsch. Okay, have a wonderful day, everyone. For those of you who do catch up online with this class, and if you access it through Torah Media Atlanta, you should be aware that Yisrael Killian, who runs Torah Media Atlanta, reached out because donations to that site are down. Those of you who do take advantage of it, I would suggest making a donation online when you do use it so that he can continue that site.